You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, Ron.
Hey, Bob, how are you?
Can't complain. How are you doing?
I'm good.
Good. Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of the Non-Zero Newsletter. This is the Non-Zero Podcast. You are Ron Campius, Washington Bureau Chief of JTA, a journalistic institution so old that the T stands for Telegraphic. The Jewish Telegraphic Agency, as the name suggests, you do news coverage that is of interest to the Jewish community, I guess, in the United States in particular. That includes, over the last year, it's included a lot of stuff in the Middle East. You previously worked for Associated Press, Jerusalem Post. You've been doing this a while. And you and I spoke not that long after October 7th of last year. So I wanted to check in with you and talk about where things have been and where they're headed. To give people a sense for how long you've kind of been at the center of this conversation, am I misremembering when I think that you actually played some kind of role in the Jimmy Carter controversy like 18 years ago when he wrote his book, Palestine, yeah. Peace, Not Apartheid? And back then, I would say the speech code was a little stricter, and even mentioning the word apartheid anywhere near the word Israel could get you into trouble, even though he was just talking about the West Bank. I think he was more kind of saying, if you're not careful, this is going to become full-fledged apartheid than saying it was that now. I don't know. But in any event, remind us, so he got into trouble, and you were part of his process of atonement, or how did that work?
It was around Hanukkah, and I got a call from the ADL saying, Jimmy Carter is going to call you.
And this is the Anti-Defamation League. Abe Foxman was the head of it at that point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, saying, because he wants to apologize for using this. I guess, you're absolutely right. What he was saying was that Israel was on its way to apartheid if it didn't retreat from what it was doing. And he thought that the title might have been conveyed that it was already there. And so he called and, he apologized through JTA. And he, it was weird because Hanukkah is not a time of atonement. This is the time of atonement.
Did you tell him to wait for another holiday? refuse to take his call?
No, but I wrote this story. And it was the first time I ever got a call from a president, just unsolicited or kind of solicited, but not by me.
Yeah.
So
did it work? Was he cleansed of his sins?
Absolutely. He is free to enjoy as many Hanukkahs as he wants now. He can do latkes and he can, he can light the candles.
And it's all thanks to you.
Yeah.
This obviously this past year and possibly the coming months will be remembered by historians, I think. And there's a few things I'm wondering. Will it be thought of as like a watershed in Israel-American relations? Will it be thought of as a watershed in relations between the American Jewish community and Israel? And if so, I suspect that will involve a distinction between the opinions of younger American Jews and older American Jews, which has really, been highlighted by these events. And then there's the anti-Semitism issue has gotten bigger. There's just a lot to talk about. I just thought I would, and I hope to get to these places, but I thought I'd start by just asking you, in a general and undirected way, as you look back, do you have a big takeaway or two on the last year?
Yeah, I mean, I think that what it's going to change most of all is the Middle East. I think that both sides, if you talk about two sides, there are multiple sides, but broadly the two sides, the pro-Israel, the Israel side, the Palestinian and Arab side, are just at their lowest point of mutual mistrust, lower than they've been in since I was a teenager, since after the October War, the Yom Kippur War. Mm-hmm. there's just no appetite in Israel right now for a two-state solution. I mean, if you want an illustration, Jonathan Dekelchen, whose son Sagi Chen is still being held captive by Hamas, he spoke to the American Jewish Committee on October the 7th. So he's kind of revered as a family of a hostage, a father of a hostage. But as he noted in his speech, he's also, by living in those areas that bordered the Gaza Strip, you're more likely to find a so-called peacenik than not. Those were the people who were trying to engage with Gazans, who were trying to Gaza Palestinians, who you know, ran dialogue, etc. And he was very much of that view. And what was remarkable, what I wrote about, my headline was about how critical he was to an establishment Jewish organization, how critical he was of the Netanyahu government, which was, I think, a shock to the American Jewish Committee's system. But what he also said, which was interesting, he said, I've also spoken to J Street. And J Street is the leading Jewish organization advocating for a two-state solution. And he said, I advised them to stand down from that right now because there's just no appetite for it. It's not something I don't believe in. I still believe in it, but it's no use bringing it up now. And I thought that was very interesting coming from somebody who, before he was thrown into this horrible personal crisis, was a peace activist. You know, he was the kind of guy that would uphold J Street, who would see, the kind of person who would say, this is, J Street is better for Israel than AIPAC and the other organizations. And here he was saying, there's just no appetite. And I think that's the more radical change. But, you know, you identified some others, and certainly the relationship with the American Jewish community is very much in flux. I mean, I think that what you saw in recent years is it's nowhere near the majority of young American Jews, I don't think, but you saw a tendency in young American Jews to become more skeptical of Israel, for some to become even anti-Zionist. And what's interesting about that is, you know, I'm always getting pushback from the right when JTA writes about those groups, like, why do you write about those groups? They're irrelevant. They're not Jewish. Well, they are Jewish. And what's more interesting, and I don't share their outlook, but what's interesting to me is that the last time you had anti-Zionist Jews in the right after the establishment of State of Israel, or even before, these were Jews who weren't, you know, they kind of disappeared eventually because the American Jewish Council, I think it was called, because they weren't really committed to Judaism. They were committed to assimilation. And I think that's what fed their anti-Zionism. These young people, they're committed Jews. Some of them are Orthodox. Some of them, they are going to stay Jewish. I think their kids are going to be Jewish. They might change their political opinions over time, and their children might have different political opinions, but they are not leaving the Jewish community. And in a sense, my perception, I don't think it's just a perception. I think it's based on my conversations with them and observance of how they live. It was validated by my rabbi's sermon on Rosh Hashanah Eve. And I didn't attend it because I was making a massive dinner for a lot of people. So I went to the services the next day when the assistant rabbi gave the sermon. Everybody was buzzing about Rabbi Amy's sermon the night before. So I went back and they record the sermons, and I was watching it. And she is a very pro-Israel rabbi. I mean, you know, she's, I would say in her political outlooking, she's liberal, but she's very pro-Israel. And she actually choked up. She said, you know, we have to integrate anti-Zionist and non-Zionist Jews into the community. And that was extraordinary, just for the message, but I think also for the recognition that they're here to stay. And I think that signals a massive sea change in how the Jewish community relates to Israel. But, you know, on the other hand, there absolutely have been Jews I know. You know, the story I tell audiences when I speak is just a couple of weeks after October the 7th, I have a dentist, and she has a recognizably Jewish name. I don't want to mention it here, but she's also very cautious. And ever since I started with her, which was during the pandemic, she's always worn a mask. I've never seen her. And the first time I saw her was my scheduled appointment, and she knows who I am. She knows what I do. And she ripped off her mask and she said, "I feel so alone." And that is, like, I've heard that phrase so often since.
Wait, then. She felt alone in what sense?
Because she is a liberal, typical liberal American Jewish Democratic voting person who absolutely does not want Donald Trump reelected, but also feels that that American Jews have been abandoned by the left, and it feels really insecure about the about where
meaning that Israel, she feels, has been abandoned by the left. Is that
yes? But American Jews as well. I mean, you know, I think that was compounded in subsequent, with the subsequent year where there was a perception. It became a political story that the campuses weren't doing enough to protect Jewish students, even those. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the campuses are seen as within the American context as a redoubt of the left. So that it wasn't just Israel wasn't protected. Mm-hmm. Like American Jews were not getting, you know, I mean, everybody says like, I didn't get texts from my non-Jewish friends, or only one non-Jewish friend texted me on October the 7th. I didn't expect any. I don't expect anybody to text me on a day that's happening thousands of miles away, as much as what happened then really did affect me. But there were like that. Go ahead.
But it's funny. There's this whole issue of conflating Jews with Israelis, or Jewish identity with Israeli allegiance. And, you know, and sometimes that is said to be a hallmark of anti-Semitism, right? And so to assume that an American Jew has any particular feelings about Israel is sometimes, in some context, condemned.
Right.
And that's a whole issue. Maybe we'll have time to get into. Let's go back a little. So, you know, it's often the case that there's a contrast between younger people and older people in political beliefs. Younger people tend to be further to the left, but often that's just an artifact of age. And then as they get older, they get more conservative. But
right.
But your sense, I gather, is that this is here to stay. The attitudes, first of all, even before October 7th, were if you paid attention, were recognizably different among many younger, you know, you might say elite Jews, I don't know, people who get involved in politics and in journalism and so on, compared to older American Jews. And, you know, I suppose on the one hand, you might have expected that October 7th itself would have pushed some of them back in the other direction. But it may have. I want to ask you about this. But one could also imagine that Israel's policies since October 7th, especially as it has continued and the devastation of Gaza has continued. And now only this week, Bibi basically said to Lebanon, we're going to turn you into Gaza, almost in so many words. We're going to turn you into Gaza if you don't somehow overthrow Hezbollah. You know, if you don't eliminate Hezbollah for us. We're going to do it, and that will involve turning you into Gaza. I would think that a lot of, you know, it has seemed to me that Bibi Netanyahu is not very worried about the congealing opinion of young American Jews, right? Like that does not seem to be at the top of his agenda.
No, I know, and absolutely not. I mean, as soon as he got back into power in 2009, from what I was hearing, he was already telling people he didn't care a lot for the American Jewish community, even AIPAC.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, he was like to the right of AIPAC. He famous like that speech he gave Congress in 2015, the sin in that speech for Democrats was not just him getting up and lambasting Barack Obama, not just sort of playing on with the Republicans, John Boehner at the time, agenda to diminish Barack Obama, but in not telling Democrats beforehand. I mean, Boehner sent out the invitation with Nancy Pelosi. Mm-hmm. She didn't know that the invitation was going out. What was interesting is that he didn't tell AIPAC either. AIPAC was completely blindsided by it, and they were really upset. I think that he is... the stuff I'd been hearing like on background off the record of what they were saying came out on the record during the year and a half that Netanyahu was out of power, and they called Bibi's brain, his ambassador Ron Dermer, who now is a cabinet minister and remains his closest advisor, actually said we can rely more on evangelicals than we can on America. Mm-hmm. He said that openly at a conference, and so the Absolutely. I don't think that he cares a whit for what American Jews think. I mean, you know, maybe he does to the degree that they can help him here, influence him here. Certainly, like AIPAC and other groups, as much as he's tried to alienate them, still, you know, they come back for more. And he, I mean, that's their raison d'etre, is to like work with whatever Israeli government is of the day, and to protect mm-hmm. Israel, to protect their relationship.
But I mean, surely he understands. This gets back to your dentist in a way. What I was going to say was, you said, she said, well, look, I don't want to vote for Trump, but I feel deserted by. Right. And I was thinking, well, it's one thing to feel deserted by some leftists, but if she feels deserted by the Democratic Party, I don't think she's paying attention. I mean, listen to what Joe, not just Joe Biden, who supposedly has some kind of special place in his heart for Israel and isn't just thinking about domestic politics. I don't know what that story is, but Kamala Harris, for all practical purposes, is a carbon copy of him. She has created zero distance between her and Biden. So I don't, if your dentist is saying she feels deserted by the Democratic Party, I would like to have a word with her, because it really, I mean, seriously. And what I would say about Bibi that's connected to that is, if he thinks, I mean, if you look at, if he thinks that the reason Biden has been afraid to cut off weapons is just because of evangelicals, he's confused. At least for now, maybe things will change when a younger generation of Jews rise to power. But as of now, the political constraints operating on a president who wants to cross an Israeli prime minister and do something as radical as cut off the flow of weapons, those constraints aren't the evangelicals, but I think they're very real, right? I mean, these Democratic politicians aren't imagining that there is actual influence, and presumably it is coming not from evangelicals, but from Jewish donors or Jewish elites, right?
I think that's true to an extent. I do think that also, I mean, you see like majority, you know, they want to win independence. They want, it's not just Jews. I mean, majorities of Americans still back Israel. That's, if you just take out Democrats, that's diminishing, but that's not enough to win an election, just to have your base. And so absolutely. It's the traditional Jewish constituents of the Democratic Party. And just for a second, to be fair to my dentist, I don't think she necessarily feels that the Democrats, but I have met Jews who are Democrats who feel that the whole party is abandoning Israel. It's, you know, you so I'm validating what you're saying, but I'm not blaming it on my dentist alone.
I want to blame your dentist. I would like to, I think your dentist deserves all the blame. So anyway, I guess what I'm saying is change in American politics with respect to Israel, I think may be slow to come. Right now, as a practical matter, notwithstanding all of the activism on college campuses, and notwithstanding real changes, well, to get back to the Carter thing, real changes in kind of the Overton window, what you're allowed to say without fear of being stigmatized, at least successfully, or ostracized, right? I mean, now you can just, you know, Ta-Nehisi Coates is saying Israel is an apartheid state. He's not just talking about the West Bank. And he did get a hostile cross-examination from a CBS journalist. But then the CBS journalist apparently got reprimanded by. So things are changing.
Oh, absolutely.
I personally think it's good that there's expanded speech. I mean, you know, so long as you are careful about policing the lines between vigorous speech and actual anti-Semitism. But I don't see that much change do you see change in the actual politics anytime in the coming years?
I don't know. I mean, I think there are tectonic shifts that could manifest soon. I think that on both sides of the aisle, frankly. I mean, I think that, you know, it went from the 4 to 6 people who call themselves a squad among Democrats to now include, in terms of calling for reductions in aid to Israel or the end of assistance to Israel, to now include Bernie Sanders, who basically is the nominal head of the, not the nominal, his actual head of the progressives. And Camila Jayapal, who is the nominal head of the Progressives. I mean, it's expanding. So I think that, you know, there. And then on the other side, you had 21 Republicans voting against aid to Israel, 21 Republicans voting against putting in the, but, you know, it's just 21, but it used to just be Thomas Massey. It went from one to 21. And they are, and it stems from an isolationism. And what I, you know, what I always try to put to Republicans when I speak to them is that, because they'll say, like, somebody like J.D. Vance, who's also kind of got an isolationist outlook, they'll say, you know, he's just about Ukraine, and it's true, that's not good, we have to talk to him about that. But he's all for Israel, which is true, he is. He, you know, he sounds all the right pro-Israel notes, so to speak. But, I, you know, that's a cognitive dissonance I don't think that the isolationist Republicans can sustain. I mean, there's a recognition, and you see it in the 21 Republicans, that Israel is just another country. It's like, it's not the 51st American state. It's another country that has its own agenda. And if you think that American money should not go to overseas wars, if you should think that American, you know, as they all claim with Ukraine, they should definitely not go to an overseas war that could draw in American troops, then that's going to apply from their perspective to Israel eventually. They can pay lip service for just so long. But I think, you know, I don't underestimate the integrity of even the most conservative Republicans. They have a point of view, and they're going to stick to it, even when it comes to Israel, I think.
Yeah, it's funny. There are a lot of contrasts between the part of the left that's critical of Israel and the part of the right that is. But I guess at the end of the day, if they agree on things like no more arms for Israel, that could reach a magnitude where it matters. I think it's a ways from that. I mean, last time around, Trump was more obliging to, I would say, not just Israel, but the kind of the hardcore, I mean, the pro-Israel right.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
You know, moved the embassy, assassinated Soleimani, got out of the Iran deal. Right.
Assassinated Soleimani for like so-called American reasons. I don't think Israel had much to do with that. But yeah, no, absolutely.
But Ron, I got to think Sheldon Adelson was pretty happy about that. You know, may God rest his soul.
John Bolton was happier. I mean, that's
well,
like...
Well, yeah.
I mean, absolutely. But I don't think that was on, you know, Miriam Adelson definitely had a wish list. And she talks about it. Fascinating. But part of it is pulling out of the Iran deal, the embassy, cutting off funds to the Palestinians, the Golan Heights. Those are the things she mentions. And absolutely. But the concern is, and now Miriam Adelson's giving him $90 million, to stave off this concern. But it's not going to be the same Trump this time as it was last time. The people who, you know, the people who surround him who were deeply, deeply pro-Israel. You know, Jared Kushner doesn't want anything to do with politics, although maybe if his father-in-law is reelected, he wants to come back in. John Bolton hates Trump, and a lot of the neoconservative right that were assisting Trump in the first term, I don't think he's going to want them near him in his second term. So, I mean, I'm there, which is to say that I've spoken to Jewish Republican donors, and that's a big concern. They say, we don't know what Trump 2 is going to be like.
Well, I think it's not implausible. You know, he famously said Israel should finish the job in Gaza. I personally think it's not crazy to imagine him green lighting like the ethnic cleansing of Gaza or more in the way of that in the West Bank. I mean, it depends on who exactly is in power in Israel. But it's no longer looking like Bibi's days are as numbered as we thought they were. And for the time being, he's dependent on coalition members who are perhaps even to his right. I mean, do you think I'm crazy to think that Trump could let a fairly extreme Israeli government go much further in these regards than we might have imagined a few years ago?
I think that Trump is looking for legacy his second time around, like every president. And I think that if he sees an Israeli government collapsing the Abraham Accords, although, you know, we don't know to what degree, like the countries that signed on to it are committed to it. They could be committed, you know, even beyond ethnic cleansing, as you're laying out in your scenario. But I don't know about that. And he wants to bring Saudi Arabia on board. And like, I forget where I read it. MBS supposedly recently said, I don't care about the Palestinians, but I do need the Palestinians. So he's not emotionally attached to the whole Palestinian issue, but he sees himself as if he can't abandon the Palestinians. And even he, like, who's becoming more of a dictator than any of his predecessors were, even he doesn't see himself as viably able to stay in power if he completely abandons the Palestinians. And I think that would weigh on Trump. He needs those actors. And beyond that, I think he doesn't want Trump is war averse. I mean, that's what he prides himself on. He does not need an expanded war in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. I forget her name, but there was a Fontenrose. There is a Kirsten Fontenrose, who was, there was a panel at the Republican convention, and everybody on it was gung-ho, and it was convened by the American Jewish Committee, but it only, you know, the speakers were Republicans because it was a Republicans convention. And everybody on it was gung-ho about Trump being pro-Israel, except Kirsten Fontenrose, who was actually on his National Security Council. And she said, the difference between Trump and Biden is that there won't be any open disagreement for the first 6 months. But that's the framework for Trump's patience. If Bibi doesn't wrap this up and gets towards a peace deal within 6 months, then he's going to go public. Trump is going to go public, and there'll be open differences between Bibi and the Trump administration.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right that he'd love to wrap up the Abraham Accords. It may be, though, and that might keep him from greenlighting anything too horrible on Israel's part with respect to Palestinians. But you know, I think that if and when this thing dies down, we should say we're taping Wednesday. This will probably go up tomorrow on Thursday. By then, Israel may have already retaliated against Iran, and that whole thing has yet to unfold as fully as it may. So we don't know how long all of this is going to go on. But I suspect that by the time it does wind down, the Abraham Accords are going to be appreciably more distant than they were on October 6th of last year. And in fact, Saudi Arabia, its public position recently, and I think only recently, became a firm sounding insistence that for them to normalize relations with Israel will require not only some kind of commitment on Israel's part toward two-state, but an actual Palestinian state with a capital in East Jerusalem. That's what they said. And of course, time heals all wounds and erodes all commitments, and eventually that may be meaningless, but I don't think it can be meaningless for the next like 18 months or something, right?
Right. Yeah, I think that's correct. And I think those would mitigate against Trump greenlighting the, you know, ethnic cleansing
But what I'm suggesting is that what he would like for his legacy, the Abraham Accords, may start seeming so remote this is just my anxieties. Pay no mind to my anxieties. Yeah. This is all pretty hypothetical, but I don't know. Here's a question. You know, there are some people saying, well, sometimes out of great trauma and great turmoil and violence comes something constructive that could not have happened otherwise, right? People say, well, God, this was so bad, we just got to fundamentally restructure things. And these people say, so maybe there will be like a two-state solution, something that to me seemed close to impossible even a few years ago.
Right.
Given the facts on the ground. Do you see any hope for that? Any hope for people looking back 5 years and saying, man, that was a terrible, terrible year or two, but they finally solved the fundamental problems in the wake of it?
I don't think it's out of the question. I think that, one factor that would feed into it is, you know, Netanyahu gave a very fiery speech at the United Nations a couple of weeks ago. While he was giving the speech, Israel was launching its beeper attack, I think was the day that it launched. No, that was the day they assassinated Nasrallah. So it was like, that was even more.
That's when Bibi was at the UN.
Right. Yeah. And buried in there, it was interesting for Netanyahu to say this, was that we will not reoccupy Gaza. We don't want to reoccupy Gaza. And that, you know, that's Netanyahu recognizing that whatever Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, the people to his right, are saying, you know, that they want to resettle Gaza, that there's just no broader appetite for it. It's an investment of time, it's an investment of money, and it's an investment of troops. And this is in a country where the people that Netanyahu is now relying upon to clear Hamas out of Gaza, to stem the to stop Hezbollah in Lebanon, those people are drawn from the so-called national religious and the secular majority. They're not the ultra-Orthodox who are also in his coalition. And so there would be immense resentment if, like, soldiers had to start going back and serving 40 days a year to quell the population of Gaza. So I think that not wanting to occupy Gaza, not wanting to have that responsibility, mm-hmm. might be something that nudges Israelis to consider again a two-state solution. I mean, and the other thing is, like, this is a country that suffered the worst horror in its history on October the 7th. They are now, what's going on now is revenge, a desire for revenge, I think.
Right.
And I think that abates. And I think, I'm old enough to remember, because I participated in it, in 1982 after the Sabra and Shatila massacre. And that was something that Israel didn't directly carry out. It kind of enabled, whether it deliberately enabled or default enabled, it's a question for history, but that drew 400,000 people to protest Israel's presence in Lebanon, for 400,000 kids into the streets of Tel Aviv. And that's as much as part of the Israeli character as a desire for revenge now. So that could, that's what helped propel the country towards Oslo. Oslo was a failure. It was a failure partly because, for a lot of reasons. One of them was, yes, that the Israeli government was too reluctant to go forward with certain things. But Israelis understood it as the prospect of peace, the prospect of the two states, and the prospects of Palestinian dignity, and they embraced that. And I think that also is part of the... I don't know how long it takes for those elements to resurface, but they are there. They are part of, I think, the Israeli sort of gestalt.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, of course, first I'd point out the guy who was found by an Israeli investigation to be at least indirectly responsible for that massacre, Ariel Sharon, and who I think must have known what was going to happen when you let that militia in, which was basically massacre hundreds of Palestinians. They later made him prime minister.
Yeah, he was reinstated. Yeah.
But the other thing that comes to mind, is, I've looked fairly carefully at what was offered at Camp David and even at Taba subsequently. And this is said to be the closest we came. And I could go into detail. I won't bore you with it. But that did not seem to me to be like a very good offer to the Palestinians, and not even to really constitute the offer of a true state. I mean, people could argue about that. And I know this is to some extent my ideology speaking, but what I would say is it just seems to me, I mean, that was before the Second Intifada that offer was made, and before October 7th. And so it just seems to me that it's pretty hard to imagine the Israeli people, leave aside how the facts of the ground have just complicated the flat-out logistics of a two-state solution since then, but it's kind of hard for me to imagine anytime soon the Israeli people getting any more generous than that. Well, now you could say, yeah, but the Palestinians are in a weaker bargaining position. They'll take what they can get. For my money, that was what was wrong with Israel's way of thinking at Camp David.
I think there's truth to that, but I think that what you're not mentioning is that Annapolis, which came after the Second Intifada, was an even more generous offer. Or I hate the word generous. It was a more.
I've looked for good documentation of that, but well, tell us what were the contours that.
For instance, Ehud Olmert, the prime minister at the time, was contemplating a symbolic return of 100,000 Palestinian refugees, which Israel had never. To Israel proper. Israel, Palestinian refugees and their descendants. That there was a more serious offer to share Jerusalem than there had been at Camp David. I mean, they were, the problem is, you know, the whole weird thing about, I mean, it's interesting. You when you're a reporter, you want to live in a universe where people aren't just talking policy and not personality. The thing about Annapolis is that the negotiators in Annapolis, I think both sides went farther than had previously done, but they hated each other more, or they hated each other in a way that I don't think the negotiators at Camp David hated each other. They kind of liked each other, spoke to them afterwards. And that's what, I think that's what helped scuttle. They were just so bitter. They were so willing to see bad faith in the other side's proposals. So, you know, is Tzipi Livni, and, you know, Netanyahu embraced this like with a vengeance, but it was Tzipi Livni who now is a big opponent of Netanyahu, came up with the, okay, now you have to recognize Israel as a Jewish state. And, you know, the Palestinians had already recognized Israel as a Jewish state. Arafat had recognized Israel as a Jewish state. So she made that like this bone of contention, even as she was negotiating further on other issues than any of her predecessors were. So I think that's because she just, and it was because, it wasn't because she was trying to sabotage the talk. She wanted this to go ahead, but it was because she was so distrustful of the Palestinians after the second intifada. So and I think, you know, broadly, I do think, like, you know, Israelis misunderstand, I think, that these peace offers is more comprehensive than they are. And I think that they would be able to, they would put up with something more encompassing than the leaders have dared to suggest. I mean, and, you know, the leaders have other considerations. They have what they're listening to the military. They have a whole bunch of considerations. And to a degree, those considerations were validated by October the 7th. Netanyahu and his cohort and a lot of Israelis had thought that they'd come to some kind of acceptable status quo for both sides, where they kept on allowing money to be dumped into the Gaza Strip, and that there was going to be this kind of sort of quasi-Palestinian Hamas recognition of Israel for the foreseeable future. And this was an outlook that Sinwar, Sinwar, the Hamas chief, was encouraging among Israelis, and that that would go on for a long time. And then it turned out that the ideology that was fueling Hamas was more implacable than Israelis wanted to realize. So, I mean, that's all, I think, in the mix. If the Israelis think that the Palestinians have divested themselves of Hamas, I think that helps a lot. When, you know, there's an interesting little wrinkle about that. A couple of months ago, for no reason whatsoever, the army did this whole thing that people might think might be a psyop or might not be a psyop, where they said they discovered the actual surveys that the famed Palestinian pollster Khalil Shikaki had conducted in Gaza, and that Hamas had been distorting them, and Hamas actually was very, very unpopular. And they just sort of leaked that to the Israelis. And that was at a time that Netanyahu was advocating for, like, staying in Gaza, for completely wiping out Hamas. And there's this tension between Netanyahu and the military over how far to go in Gaza. And I think that was, you know, if it was a psyop and they were making it up, and and Hamas actually was more popular in Gaza, or was actually popular in Gaza, it was a psyop aimed at people who support Netanyahu, because the army wanted to get out of Gaza. But I think, you know, just the fact that they were doing that shows that the Israeli public is susceptible to the notion that the Palestinians want peace, but they just have a terrible leadership, as opposed to the Palestinians are implacable haters of Israel. And I think that if you the military understands, I think, that better than even I do. And if they understand that, I think that there's a prospect for the getting back to what you originally said, to for a two-state solution, but not now.
Yeah. So in terms of what's driving Israel's strategy right now, I mean, it's the kind of war on all fronts strategy. And I guess a premise of what I'm saying is, it seems to me that with respect to Iran, well, Israel's just not been shy about escalating since October 7th, it seems to me, particularly with respect to Iran, the embassy compound in Syria, assassinating Haniyeh on Iranian territory, and so on. It seems to me they almost welcome a fight on all fronts. And of course, you know, once they did like the pager thing and then assassinating Nasrallah, it was, and, you know, like, we're taking on Lebanon. And of course, that, strictly speaking, I mean, it wasn't wasn't the only way to make northern Israel safe, right? I mean, you could have said, okay, well, we'll do the ceasefire in Gaza. I mean, maybe it would have been hard for Netanyahu politically. I don't know. But in principle, you could have just done what I think Biden would have really liked. We'll do the ceasefire in Gaza, and then the missile fire into northern Israel will stop, or even we'll do the three-week ceasefire that Biden wanted, which would have accomplished the same thing without some of the sacrifices in Gaza that Bibi wanted to make. Didn't want to do all that. It's like war on all fronts. And I'm curious, you know, whenever, with any situation like this, you can ask the question of motivation and what they have in mind at multiple levels. You can say, well, in the councils of national security, what kinds of arguments are being made? And you can say, well, at the level of domestic politics, what kinds of calculations are being made? And you can say, well, what's driving the grassroots sentiments that's driving the domestic politics? Now, you said earlier that to some extent, what we've seen since October 7th is vengeance. And I'm sure it would be surprising if at the grassroots level, I mean, given what I think about human nature, if there were none of that. And obviously, at the level of political calculation, Netanyahu succeeded in keeping himself in. I mean, it was obvious from the beginning that the recipe for him to stay in power, notwithstanding the forces mitigating against that, was eternal war, right? And he had a natural incentive to keep the war going because everybody's saying, well, he's going to have to step down after the war, but he won't until then. So at that level of domestic politics, you could say that that's his calculation. But I assume there is also a national security calculation that is getting some respect at elite levels about why it makes sense to engage all of these forces at once. And I guess it's something like, well, given that we had this card to play with like beginning with the pagers, given how much intelligence we actually had on Hezbollah, this was a once in a lifetime opportunity to, if nothing else, mow the lawn, as they used to say, for a long time there. And Iran, without Hezbollah to help it out, this is now a chance to do significant damage to whatever, their military infrastructure. I don't know if they're thinking about regime change. I don't know what. But what do you think, to the extent that this is a national security exercise on Israel's part, what do you think the logic is?
Well, I think the logic is, you know, what Netanyahu says it is. His overarching goal in Gaza was to crush Hamas and remove Hamas. I do think everything you've mentioned certainly has a role, but I do think that, like I said, the mow the lawn mentality existed before October the 7th, that you had this sort of thing like, okay, we're going to have a limited engagement with Hamas every 2 years, 2009, 2012, 2014, and 2021. And it's going to be, you know, painful, a little painful for us, more painful for them. But we'll go along because they have an interest in staying in power. They don't have an interest in being destroyed. Same with Hezbollah, same with Iran. And maybe those attitudes really do prevail in Hezbollah and Iran, but
I think they do. I think that's the irony. I think Hamas was the one thing they got wrong. Sinwar is a true believer. And yeah, that was the difference.
And I think now I think the mentality in Israel is that we can't afford to, you know, with 10,000 or how many missiles Hezbollah had aimed at Israel, we can't afford to think anymore that Nasrallah speaks one game and plays another game. We can't afford to necessarily think that Iran speaks one game with its burgeoning or soon to be nuclear capacity, speaks one game and plays another game. In other words, like, you know, the rhetoric that Netanyahu employed is actually, you know, it's almost as if he woke up and he said, wait a second, maybe I was actually telling the truth all those years, that we can't afford to have these people on our borders. And I think that's what the, you know, I've been in background briefings with Yoav Gallant, who, you know, he and there's no love lost between him and Netanyahu, but I can tell you that that is the, that's the outlook. Things have changed. Things have changed in terms of how they see themselves in the Middle East. But, you know, and everything that happens, for whatever, you know, geopolitical reasons, complexities, it happens, from them, it has a very sort of simple explanation. Like, they never had any trouble with Yemen before. Yemen was even maybe formally at war in 1948, but there were never. Now the Houthis are sending missiles to to Israel. And it's like we're getting assailed even from Yemen. We're living in this very, really dangerous neighborhood, and we have to do as whatever we can to mitigate the dangers. I would also say that the other factor is, yes, you talk to administration and officials, and they'll say that Bibi was moving the goalposts all the times in terms of the negotiations. But they are more; they will say that Hamas and Sinwar was the greater problem in terms of getting there. So I don't even know if Bibi had been more accommodating, if we'd be in a different place today.
Mm-hmm. I ask about this because, to a lot of people, some people on the left, some people on the right, to people in America who are inclined to be critical of Israel, to a lot of them, what this looks like from the outside is just Israel has gone berserk, right? Like, just wanton slaughter. And let's face it, I mean, there has been the idea among some Israeli elites for some time that, look, with these non-state actors like Hamas and Hezbollah, to some extent, the only way, since you can't deal with them as traditional state actors, you have to make some of the civilian population suffer by virtue of their actions and hope that eventually the pressure on them will grow and so on. And I've got to think that some of that thinking is involved. But at any rate, with all the civilian casualties first in Gaza and now in Lebanon, I'm wondering about the enduring effect of that on American attitudes toward Israel. And I don't really know, because I think, look, most of Americans still just don't think much about it. Most American voters, but the elite level is a different matter. There was a question I was going to ask you earlier that may be relevant to this, which is that there's a difference among the differences between the critical of Israel left and the critical of Israel right. The critical of Israel right talks a lot about the influence of the Israel lobby in kind of, the broad sense, maybe AIPAC and beyond. On the left, there's a little more reluctance to that. I think it's partly because the far left has bought so heavily into this American empire model, where it's like the American empire, everyone is America's proxy, including Israel. Like, that's that narrative. Maybe that's part of it. And relatedly, on the right, I think you on the fringes of the right critical of Israel faction, you've got more out and out anti-Semitism. And the discussion of Israeli influence on American politics in the right, on the fringes, it shades into anti-Semitism.
Right.
And I'm wondering if you're not going to get, you tell me. I guess I would say I have not noticed as much discussion on the left of political constraints on Biden by virtue of the Israel lobby as I would have expected. And I'm wondering if that's going to change and whether Bibi would really welcome that. I mean, he wouldn't, I think. I mean, whether he's really like thinking this through is what I mean to say. Does any of that make sense to you?
Yeah, no, it does. I think that, I think that there have been manifestations of anti-Semitism on the left. I think that's what's worrying people. But I do think that, towards the degree that, the whole Israel lobby narrative hasn't taken as much hold this time has to do with people understand that, Biden keeps on saying that he has an emotional deep mm-hmm. attachment to Israel. And so, you don't need the Israel lobby when you have that. And I think that really resonates for a lot of American Jews, but I think it's also like, people on the left aren't stupid. They see that and they realize that that's probably one of the big things. I think that because Kamala Harris is a little bit more of a blank slate on a lot of issues, that if she comes into office and she makes good on her rhetoric, which, as you pointed out, there's like the zero difference between her and Biden, then I think, maybe that's going to, and it might be, I don't see politicians as being as cynical creatures as a lot of people do. If she is like that, it might be for American security calculations. It might be for a bunch of reasons. It might be because she too has attachments to Israel. They just don't run as deep as Biden's. But people are going to, I think people are then going to start saying, yeah, you know, she's doing this because of, you know, of the Israel lobby. She's in thrall. Mm-hmm. That could come up again for sure.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I would say, as far as the anti-Semitism on the left, I mean, first of all, the accusations of anti-Semitism on the left tend to be pointed at people who are identifying strongly with the Palestinian cause. I personally don't think saying from the river to the sea is in and of itself evidence of anti-Semitism. And I think different people mean different things by it. And I know for sure that a number of people don't mean, you know, kill all Israelis or anything remotely like that. But on the right, there isn't, by and large, any particular identification with the Palestinian cause. It's just quit spending American money on, you know, foreign wars. And so it's a very different. So let's see. So, as you know, what we generally do on the podcast here is we talk a while on the public podcast, and then we go into overtime, which is available to paid subscribers of the Non-Zero newsletter, which I encourage everyone to become. And once you become one, you can just set up your podcast feed so that it always has the overtime segments. And Ron, you've been kind enough to say you'll stick around and talk some more. There's plenty to talk about. But before we move into that part of the conversation, is there anything else you want to say by way of reflection or summing up? I mean, there's so much to talk about.
There is a lot. I mean, I think that there's this sort of, there's a breakdown in understanding of, you know, how the Israelis perceive themselves in this war, and like what you said, like the growing horrors, at least among the elites, that the effect it has on the Palestinians. And you know, I think that has to be resolved to a degree by obviously Israel is going to have to analyze a lot more about what it did. I think, you know, the Israelis are repelled by the idea that they're committing genocide. They absolutely reject it, but they've kind of already acknowledged that they've committed war crimes because they rounded up a few soldiers and jailed them for effectively committing war crimes. And they're gonna, and I think that sort of reflection and you know, I think that they might also eventually not the country, but certain individual officials might face crimes against humanity if they're found to have actually deliberately caused or prevented the delivery of aid into the Gaza Strip. I think that's, they say they're going to have to grapple with that. But I think on the other hand, there's an expectation. I think that there's a fair expectation from the international community that they will have to grapple with how far that they sort of reflexively go whenever Israel gets into this sort of situation where it is at war and it's accused of the most extreme things. And so, you know, the metaphor I've been trying to come up with in recent days is like the different ways that we use depraved indifference and we're discussing crimes. So if a drug dealer is selling people heroin and he's lacing it with fentanyl and they're dying, he's going to be accused of depraved indifference. And the conclusion is that that we should really crack down on the whole illicit drug trade, because that's what leads people to have this kind of depraved indifference. On the other hand, if, you know, a policeman is trying to stop a crime and he kills a civilian without thinking, that's going to be a depraved indifference. But we're not necessarily going to say that we have to dismantle law and order and that we have to dismantle the police. And Israelis are wondering why they're automatically, in some cases, not in every case, why they're automatically consigned to the former case where, if they're doing something that seems objectionable and seems horrible, that is ripping people's hearts, there are people out there who are going to say, let's just dismantle the whole enterprise, as opposed to the latter case, like with the metaphor I gave with the police, where they say, let's reform, let's talk about how we fix this, let's talk about how we take this necessary entity, the police or Israel in the metaphor, and make it better. And I think that is something that Israelis, Israel and the pro-Israel community, the Jews, they want the world to understand why those two things are so different, and why when you talk about dismantling Israel for whatever it does, it seems so threatening and so aggrieving. those are the thoughts I've been having in recent days.
Okay. I want to continue that train of thought in overtime and drill down on what you mean by dismantling and also revisit something I said to you last time we talked, which is sometimes I get the impression that the Israelis, not necessarily American Jews who care about Israel, but have almost given up on the world liking them and how that may influence things. So anyway, if you become a member of the Non-Zero Newsletter, you can listen to the rest of this. We hope you will, partly because we hope you want to listen to it, but also because we can use the support. But anyway, thanks to everyone who's listened. And now we will head into overtime.